Thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. Thousands of Chicago teachers are picking their union leaders weeks after ratifying a new labor agreement. A new report explores how healthcare programs for undocumented people impact hospital debt.
I loved this show even before I was on it.
And generations of kids grew up with her. We sit down with actress Sonia Manzano to hear about her time playing Maria on Sesame Street and more. Now to some of today's top stories. The U.S. Supreme Court today heard arguments over birthright citizenship. At issue is whether lower court judges went too far by blocking the Trump administration's order nationally rather than just issuing injunctions for only their jurisdictions. The U.S. Solicitor General John Sauer represented the Trump administration's argument that the president's restrictions on birthright citizenship should take effect in at least 27 states. But New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Platkin argued on behalf of the states, including Illinois, that they'd lose millions of dollars in health and other benefits for U.S. children.
The original meaning of the citizenship clause extended citizenship to the children of former slaves, not to people who are unlawfully or temporarily present in the United States. The merits arguments we are presenting to the lower courts are compelling. For those reasons, we ask the court to grant the applications.
This case is about birthright citizenship, but it's about whether the rule of law and the constraints on the executive, and as Justice Jackson said, whether the president can act like a king. The answer I think the court is going to say is no, he cannot.
Lawmakers in Springfield have passed a bill in both houses in response to the 2024 police killing of Sonya Massie.
I know that this legislation in Illinois is a kind of common sense legislation that will bring the kind of thing that this will never happen to another family.
Her father, James Wilburn, joined lawmakers and attorneys today in support of the bill that would require law enforcement to have stricter hiring practices, including robust background checks and previous employment records. Former Sangamon County Sheriff's Deputy Sean Grayson is facing charges in connection with Massie's death after he shot and killed her last July in her home after she'd called 911 for help. Records showed he'd worked for six law enforcement departments in 4 years. In February, Massie's family received a $10 million settlement from the county on what would have been her 37th birthday. Chicago taxpayers could be on the hook for $15 million to the private firm that leases the city's parking meters. Attorneys are recommending the city pay that amount to compensate the firm for taking parking spaces out of service and not ticketing during the COVID pandemic under Mayor Lori Lightfoot. The much-despised parking meter deal requires the city to make payments to compensate the firm for lost revenue when meters are moved, temporarily taken out, or used by motorists with disabled parking permits. A spokesperson for Mayor Brandon Johnson is calling the settlement a victory. They say the firm initially demanded $322 million from the city. Evanston Mayor Daniel Biss is the latest candidate to enter the race to replace outgoing Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. Biss made the announcement on social media today. He was just reelected to a second term as Evanston mayor in April with 63% of the vote. You might also remember Biss from his campaign for governor in 2018, when he came in a distant second to J.B. Pritzker. The 47-year-old former UChicago math professor joins State Senator Laura Fine of Glenview and progressive media star Kat Abugazela in the race. Later in the program, how undocumented health care services are impacting hospitals in Illinois. But first, Chicago Teachers Union members are voting for their next leaders. Details on who's running next.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Thousands of rank-and-file members of the Chicago Teachers Union are voting once again. Weeks after ratifying a new labor agreement, educators will now be voting on their leadership for the next 3 years. The two candidates running are the current president, Stacey Davis Gates, and her opponent, Erica Meza. Here to tell us more about both of them is our own Matt Masterson. Matt, let's start with the incumbent. Of course, we all know her, Stacey Davis Gates. Remind us about her first term as president and what she's been emphasizing to her members to get reelected.
Yeah, a member, of course, of the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, or CORE, which came into power in 2010. She took over in 2002 as president, Davis Gates did, and her biggest victories during that first term, of course, were the union's heavy backing of its organizer, Brandon Johnson, in his successful mayoral campaign, and more recently, the securing the new four-year labor contract with the Chicago Public Schools. When she spoke with me this week, she focused on the efforts that CORE has had in expanding the union's reach beyond just education, making it a power player into issues of equity and social justice as well. This is work that she hopes to continue if she is reelected to a second term.
That's right. And Davis Gates took over in 2022 after Jesse Sharkey. Tell us about her opposing candidate, Erica Meza, and why she says she's running.
Yeah, Meza's been a CTU member for more than 20 years. She's a teacher at Washington High School on the South Side. She's a member of the Respect, Educate, Advocate, Lead, or Real Caucus, which has been highly critical of CORE. Her and her caucus claim that CORE should have done more to improve pay and teacher prep time in the current contract. They also say that they aren't being responsive to current members, that they are out of touch with rank and file members, and that members aren't being heard when they bring their complaints to the union. They want to improve classroom working conditions, expand the union's existing grievance area so that members who do have complaints, they can bring these and be heard as well to the union.
And Meza, she's also portrayed the current CTU as a fractured union. What does she mean by that?
She said some members don't feel heard. They don't feel supported by the current leadership. She's expressed issues of transparency with CORE leadership. She's also been critical of CORE's relationship with other labor allies, including SEIU, Local 73. They ran into issues during the most recent labor negotiations. There was a proposal regarding teachers' assistance that drew the ire of SEIU. They say that they don't have faith in CORE being able to fix that relationship. Davis Gates told me she sees SEIU as family. She says this is more of just a small rift than she sees them as allies that are going to be a big part of CTU's power going forward.
And what has Stacey Davis Gates said that she would focus on if elected to a second term?
Yeah, she wants to continue expanding the CTU's reach. She's talked about dreaming big. She wants to implement the many, many facets of this new labor contract that was just ratified a few weeks ago. She also wants to fight back against attacks from Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. going forward. She said that the union has to demonstrate how to handle these attacks for the nation, essentially, going forward to make sure that they can withstand anything that comes out of Washington, D.C.
So, Matt, what are the next steps? What happens next?
Yeah, so voting takes place on Friday. It's three-year terms. The results will probably be in either Friday night or sometime over the weekend. And it's not just the president that's being elected. It's their vice president, their recording secretary, and the financial secretary, all these officials for the union for the next 3 years.
Interesting insight into the process for CTU, a very large union. Matt Masterson, thank you.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Matt's full story on our website. It is all at WTTW.com/news. Advocates are trying to save a program that provides health insurance to immigrants without legal status before the budget season wraps up in Springfield. More than 32,000 undocumented people ages 42 to 64 currently get coverage from the program Health Benefits for Immigrant Adults. But with the state facing a budget deficit and federal funding uncertainties, Governor J.B. Pritzker cut the program from his proposed spending plan. Now a new report from the University of Chicago links the program to reduced financial burdens on hospitals. Joining us on Zoom is one of the report's researchers, Arasha Martinez Cardoso, a public health professor at the University of Chicago. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So your research, it tracked programs like Health Benefits for Immigrant Adults and their impact on hospital finances in Illinois. Tell us what you found, please.
Yeah, definitely. So we were interested in understanding the economic impacts of the HBIA, HBIS programs for the state beyond just the individuals who are enrolled in the program. So what we did is we looked at hospital finances before and after the policies were passed, and we compared hospitals in Illinois to those in Wisconsin and in Indiana, which didn't have the policy. And we just tracked and used statistical models to look at How did the hospital finances change? And was there a significant change that was associated with the timing of the HBIA-HBIS policies? We specifically looked at this outcome called uncompensated care, which is essentially when hospitals cover care for patients that isn't compensated to them or paid back to them from patients or insurers. And so when we looked at changes in uncompensated care from 2017 to 2020 before the policy was passed, and we looked at trends from 2021 to 2023 when the policy was implemented, we see that hospitals in Illinois experienced about a 15% reduction in one of the outcomes called bad debt. And we don't see that reduction in our comparison states of Wisconsin and Indiana. And what we think these results are telling us is that there is an association between the passage of these policies that provided health insurance for individuals who are previously uninsured and compensation for hospitals who provide care to these patients, as well as all Illinoisans.
And as mentioned, you know, parts of the program are on the chopping block because of the budget uncertainties, the current budget proposal. Advocates, of course, are pushing to keep it. So how should, you know, hospital administrators, policymakers, advocates be looking at your research and what you found?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, this was a landmark program. We were the first state in the nation to provide this kind of health care coverage that was state funded for immigrants who are excluded from federal programs like Medicaid and Medicare. And this was coming off of the COVID pandemic when we understood that taking care of everybody's health was a benefit for the entire state, and that there was a large group of Illinoisans who had been part of our state, working, essential workers who had contributed to our economy, our community, and it was important to take care of their health. And there were certainly a lot of costs associated with providing healthcare. But what we think is that many of these individuals were uninsured for a really long time. So they had a lot of unmet health needs that the program had to cover that were quite expensive. And we believe that some of those costs and estimates will sort of regularize over time. But what we know in public health is that providing health insurance can be expensive, but long term, it's an important investment in the health of the individuals are covered, our healthcare system overall, the benefit of the public health benefit to everybody else that benefits from having a healthier workforce, a healthier populace. And our research specifically points to the benefits for hospitals who now get dollars for care that they were already providing to a lot of individuals that they now are being reimbursed for, and it creates a more robust healthcare environment that benefits everybody.
So all of that said, though, the Office of the Auditor General released an audit of the program in February saying, quote, the initial cost estimates for HBIA for those ages 42 to 54 for fiscal years 2021, 22, and 23 totaled $68 million, while the actual total cost was $262.2 million, or 286% higher. That is a significant amount. What do you say to lawmakers then who think the program should be cut just because the state can't afford it?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to think about tinkering with the program to make it perhaps more cost efficient. For example, the state has moved enrollees to what's called managed care to help manage costs. There's ways we can be more efficient about how we deliver the healthcare or what gets covered. But overall, I think there's a lot of evidence in the health and healthcare and public health literature that these, you kind of say, have to spend a little money at the beginning to ensure health in the long run. And I think it's important to point out that people are going to need this healthcare regardless of whether the state covers it or somebody else covers it. People are going to need to go to the hospital for diabetes care, for cancer, for strokes, for primary care, to have their babies. And so the hospitals before the program were incurring the cost of that program, and that then got shifted and spread out to everybody else. And with the state covering the program, not only does that relieve the burden on the hospitals, but it's in some ways a more efficient way to deliver healthcare, because now people are going to go see their primary care physician for their diabetes medication or to get heart screenings, rather than waiting to go to the emergency room when their diabetes and blood sugars are out of whack or they've had a stroke. So it is a lot of money. I'm a taxpayer. I live in Illinois. I think about the costs of all of our public investments. But as a researcher, we understand that investing now is going to save us in the long run. And the last thing I'll add is for this particular age group, this 42 to 64, that is being this part of the program is being cut. It's important to remember that this is our prime working age population. And so it's important to keep these folks healthy so they can continue to working, so they can continue raising their families. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that when people are uninsured during this period of time, that when they become insured at 65, they are much more expensive for the healthcare system. And so if we can keep people healthy and insured now, it's gonna stay our state in the long run. And again, I think, go ahead, I'll stop
there. Well, it's okay. Well, we've got just a couple of seconds left, Aisha. I wanted to ask you before we let you go, this research is still ongoing. What's next?
Yeah, we are flipping our models and our analysis all the ways that we can to make sure that our findings are robust. There's a lot of things that could be going on. One of the other things we find is that it's counties that have the highest level of program enrollment that see the largest effects. So we think it really is the program that is doing something, but we're checking all sorts of things. And then we're also going to look at emergency room and hospitalization utilization among the period of time when these programs were passed. Again, to think about, is the are the programs helping us provide more efficient forms of healthcare, such as primary care, rather than expensive hospitalizations and emergency rooms? And okay, this is important. I'm in California now, and they're considering their own program. So we've led the nation, and I think it's important for us to think about not only
more research to come, it sounds like. Yeah, we'll absolutely be on the lookout for that. We'll have you back to tell us more about it when that research is done. Aisha Martinez-Cardoso, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, we sit down with Maria from Sesame Street. Sunny day sweeping the clouds away. That's how Sonia Manzano spent her career for more than four decades. The actress hung out with Big Bird, Oscar the Grouch, and the whole gang when she played Maria on the beloved program Sesame Street. Manzano was recently in Chicago, where she spoke with Chicago Commons and supporters about the importance of early childhood education. We sat down with her while she was in town and took a trip down memory lane. How did you get to Sesame Street?
It was such a wild time. It was the late 60s. America was a different place. It was an idealistic place. It was the civil rights movement, and Joan Ganz Cooney had this brilliant idea of using television to reach underserved children. I remember her on a talk show. She said, the people who run the world can read, therefore these children have to know how to read. So it was an exciting time, and I simply got cast. I think the most important things happen to you when you're not paying that much attention. I was in a Broadway show. I didn't realize it was going to go on and on for so many years.
What was the importance of your role on Sesame Street at the time? Because there was not a lot of Latino representation on television.
I loved the show even before I was on it. I saw it at the Student Union of Carnegie Mellon University. I walked in, and there was a very bald, very young James Earl Jones reciting the alphabet. I said, what is this? I thought it was a show that taught lip reading, because, you know, he's very deliberate, A, B, C, as he is. Yes. The letters flashed over his head. I said, what the heck is this? But I saw Susan and Gordon, this beautiful African-American couple, I was stunned, because at that time you did not see people of color on television, and if you did, they weren't the beautiful Susan and Gordon, and they certainly weren't any Latinos. And I was born and raised in the Bronx, watching a lot of television and wondering, how could I contribute to a society that didn't see me? You know, I wasn't in, I didn't see people like me. People would say, do you want to be a teacher when you grow up? I don't know, I never saw a Puerto Rican teacher. You know, you don't. If you can't see it, you can't be it. And that moment of seeing Susan and Gordon gave me a little inspiration.
Did you know that the show would be as groundbreaking as it went on to be?
No, no one could have possibly known. It was a perfect storm. I always think of the Beatles. You know, the Beatles separately are great musicians, but they're not who they became as a group. And we had Jim Henson, Puppets, the Muppeteer, Joe Raposo, a brilliant composer who was able to write real music for Children, John Stone, who was a visionary as far as television goes. And this was a great crash of creativity and civil involvement.
Compared to your time on Sesame Street and that what that show provides, how does your new show, Alma's Way, how does it address the learning needs of children today?
The good people at PBS Kids asked me to create a show, a Latin family show, so of course I made it. My old neighborhood in the South Bronx is where Alma and her family lives. And I took cues from Sesame Street. Sesame Street looked around society and said, kids need this. And that's what we provided. So I looked around today, and I said, what do kids need today? And I saw overcrowded classrooms, kids who didn't speak English, a lot of testing, and a lot of kids who, if they couldn't pass tests or couldn't memorize information, thought they weren't smart. So the idea of Alma's Way is to make sure kids know everybody has a brain. Everybody can put two and two together. That's just a given. So that these children who are might be underserved or in stressful situations don't think that just because they can't pass a test or memorize information at the same moment that the next kid does, that's where we're heading. We want everybody to learn everything at the same time. That has nothing to do with your intellectual powers.
Have you noticed a shift in children's educational programming and how kids are taught today?
People ask me this all the time. Kids haven't changed, but what we expect of them has changed. We expect them on the internet because of COVID. The classes were held on television, so we expect that of them. We expect them to learn at the same moment as their peers, as I mentioned before, not at their own pace. They are still as curious as they ever were.
Seems like in some ways you kind of did become a teacher.
I guess I just observe what's going on around me and I'm very curious. This place, this Nia Family Center, I was waiting in the door and a kid comes in and says, blueberry muffins. I mean, she was ready to identify the objects around her. She must have been around three.
You've written a number of children's books throughout your career. What inspired you to write your memoir, Becoming Maria?
Becoming Maria, Love and Chaos in the South Bronx. Well, I guess you get to a certain age where you want to really make sense of your journey. And the only way to make sense of it, I thought, was to take it outside of myself and write it down. I had to see family members I hadn't seen in many years in order to come to understand how we all impacted each other's lives.
In your book, you also talk about feeling invisible, even in your own house, and the struggles that happened while you were growing up. But the moment you learned to read, that's when it changed how you saw yourself.
Yes. I was raised in a household that was ruled by domestic violence, so that took precedent over everything. It was always, that was ruling the house. And we were reading Dick and Jane books at school, and I was always ahead, and the teacher would not let me turn the page. I didn't know why we read these books. And then one day I was on the Third Avenue L. That's why I love the trains here in Chicago. And I was looking at the ads, and I asked my sister, what did they say? And she went, why don't you try reading it? And I thought, reading? I thought reading was something you only did in school with Dick and Jane books. Well, I saw the ads, and all of a sudden, the words just fell into place, and I sounded the words out, and it was like the world opened to me. And I said, it's not, you can read anywhere, you read signs. And that was an exciting moment to me. And it showed me, you don't have to take a kid the whole way. Just point them in a certain direction. Just say, try reading it. And, you know, I took it the rest of the way.
What is your reaction to what's happening with this administration and its attempts to cut funding for PBS?
It's awful, as one might imagine. It's distracting. I hate to even talk about it because it's like giving it power, almost. And maybe the administration will change its mind. It goes back and forth, and I'm not sure what it stands for, because it goes back and forth. So I don't know, we'll see what happens. It certainly is distressing, but people will prevail.
What's next for Sonia Manzano?
I want to work on another book. It certainly is disconcerting that there's an erasure of history. a desire to do that in this country, so I feel I want to write more Puerto Rican stories so that we are not forgotten.
Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet her, and you can find more details about Sonia Manzano and her projects on our website. And that's our show for this Thursday night. You can stream Chicago Tonight on our WTTW YouTube channel every evening and catch up on any programs you may have missed. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 7 for the Week in Review. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.